This is Laura Gray, and it is Friday, November 20th, and I'm sitting for the second time, almost exactly a month later, with Bob Massey in Somerville. And we had left off, this is tape two, side one, and we had left off last month about the effects of the HIV crisis and Bob getting affected with the HIV infection. And he had just finished telling me how losing his first marriage was one of the toughest things in his life. So, Bob, thank you for this second sitting. And what I wanted to ask you is if there's any more reflections you want to make in this time period of the 80s, as to how you think this HIV infection and news affected you. I've heard personally, you may have other things to say, and please do, but I'm also interested in any ways politically or how you felt about your care providers.
Okay. Well, I think that a theme that runs through my life, and I think that I believe I talked about to some degree in the first tape, is that one challenge, I think, for any person with a chronic illness, and particularly with hemophilia, and then particularly with HIV, is to judge, is to sense how much these phenomena that overtake you are going to affect your relationship with other people. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the case of hemophilia, I had to work with all of the challenges and prejudices and anxieties that people, you know, other people, and we're all different, but that other people felt towards people with chronic illness, and particularly with braces. And then when HIV came along, and I told the story, I think, about the Life magazine cover last time, seeing it in the supermarket from very far away, and it was about the time that people were really understanding the range of the epidemic, and it said in huge letters, red letters, that I remember, I could read it from 30 feet away, it said, AIDS. And then the subtitle was, Now No One Is Safe.
How did that affect you?
Well, I think that...
you can lean back if you
want. Okay, thank you. I think that...
our last sitting was interrupted, so now Bob and I are sitting together. It's December 9th in the morning, and we're going to continue at where we had left off, which was, you know, just his thoughts about how, your thoughts, Bob, about how HIV has sort of changed you or affected you politically. And then let's start there. And you were saying you were in Star Market and saw this magazine.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think my reaction to seeing the magazine was... that I began to wonder whether I would have to start concealing my HIV status from people.
Because it frightened you?
Because of other people's fear and discrimination and so forth. I really wasn't sure where this was going to go.
Had you ever had to conceal anything before?
Not really. I think I'd always taken the point of view that... you know, this was ultimate, that hemophilia was ultimately not a frightening illness, that most of the things people were frightened about were not true, and so it was a question of explaining that you weren't going to bleed to death from a cut or something that was going to, so that once people's familiarity rose, their anxiety dropped, and you would be more inclined to be accepted. But HIV had this, these extremely emotional and panic-inducing qualities. I mean, it touched so many things. It was a blood-borne illness. It was sexually transmitted. It was inevitably fatal. I mean, it carried, at the time, it was viewed as inevitably fatal. So it carried with it a lot of the sort of it touched many of the most sensitive areas in people's mental and emotional makeup.
What about your mental and emotional makeup?
Well, for me, I had, and I don't know whether this was a form of denial or what, but I, as I think mentioned earlier, I had a bit of a wait-and-see approach, because I had been told, and I forget whether I related this story before, but I had just learned about my HIV status simply by going in for an annual checkup at New York Hospital, where a set of blood tests were drawn and other things were done, and saw the orthopedist. And I went back, I guess, a few weeks later and saw Dr. Margaret Hilgartner, who had been my caregiver since I was 6 or 7 years old, and here I was 36 or whatever. And, 28 when I guess when I found out about this. Yeah, so I'd known her a long time, and I remember her saying, well, you know about this virus, which I think at the time wasn't even called HIV, it was called HTLV-3, and it was just another peculiar virus that may or may not have been related to the cause of what was also called at that time gay-related immune disease, or GRID, and people were just piecing together, I guess in 82, 83, that these were all linked, and just coming up with an antibody test. And I remember Margaret saying, well, you know, we've run all these tests, your liver functions are a little elevated, which I heard every time, which was a sign that my liver was deteriorating from hepatitis, we now know. But, and I said, yeah, I'd like to know. So she looked up, she took out one book and looked up my code name, my code number, and then she took out another book and looked up that number for the results, and she said, oh, well, you're positive. And I remember thinking in years later when there was a huge superstructure formed to help people cope with the news that they were positive, and, you know, they wouldn't give you the results on the phone, you had to come in, you had to meet with all. Well, none of that existed, and I remember leaving and thinking, well, okay, you know, another bit of news. But I was not shocked, and I certainly don't think that the caregivers failed, because what was known at the time, we just didn't know very much. And I suppose later, when sort of AIDS hysteria intensified, then I might have liked to have had some greater context and discussion when I got the news. But at the time, nobody really knew anything. So I remember walking out. I do believe, I went back. I was still living in New York City at the time. And we went back and told my first wife, Dana. And I think that this, although she didn't show it, I think this had a much more frightening impact on her than I was aware of, or that I think anybody was really aware of, perhaps even she was aware of. Mm-hmm. We moved to Boston in 1984, and so...
Right, and you actually talked at length about how you felt...
We talked
this,
about...
This had affected your marriage, and it ultimately destroyed that first marriage.
Well, I mean, we were married in 82, and when this emerged in 84, one of the first significant impact, my first wife was finishing her PhD, and there's a question of when we would try to have children. We were in our 20s, so it didn't seem like an enormous rush, but on the other hand, and Dana was about to start teaching after she finished her PhD. By 85, 86, we'd been married for 4 years, moving into 5 years, and we were starting to wonder, what did this mean? So we ended up enrolling in a weekly counseling session at the Fenway Community Health Center here in Boston, which was a sort of unusual situation. I think we were one of the very few straight couples who were in there. The whole thing was geared towards, I guess, primarily gay men, but gay and lesbian people. And here we were, this, you know, heterosexual couple coming in and talking about having children. But I don't remember the name of our counselor, but he was very, and he clearly, you know, specialized in working on gay relationships. But he was very helpful to us, I thought, at the time. And we talked out a great many things. And then we decided to try to have children on the assumption that I seemed very healthy. We still didn't know what the probability that this really would have any impact on hemophilia was. I mean, it was before people started dying of HIV with hemophilia. But and there was also the challenge that, well, perhaps if I were we were to wait, I would get sick, and my my sort of infectivity would go up, and therefore pose more of a danger to Dana and so forth. So we decided, and we had no idea whether getting pregnant would be would require multiple months, or whether it was something that would unfold fairly quickly. And I think that in my son Sam's case, I think Dana got pregnant the second month. And of course, we were very targeted, and when we were trying to get pregnant, because you know we had long before committed to safe sex, and so this is a question of sort of some very isolated incidents to see what would happen. I think Dana, it's hard to, looking back on this 20 years later, it's easy to say maybe we were just being completely foolish. At the time, we thought we were really working through all the issues and making an informed judgment, and a judgment that felt that we were taking into account as many of the unknowns as we could, and that on balance it seemed like something that was not such a great risk.
You never really then blamed the physicians. You never were in the situation where you ever wondered, should I be treating myself? Shouldn't I be treating myself? Did you get encouragement or discouragement from your doctor?
Well, I felt... Now, there's a very interesting twist to all of this, which I'll just mention briefly, and perhaps we can come back to it. I don't believe I mentioned it before, but when I was in between high school and college, I had the opportunity to spend... I took a year off, because I graduated a year early from high school, and I went and spent 6 or 7 months working for Senator Jackson. Did I tell you about this?
I think so, but
go ahead. Well, the key finding, the key point of this is that I became, and this is in 1972, 73 really, and in the spring of 74, I became very interested in what I saw as a deeply flawed system through which American blood companies were collecting, American pharmaceuticals were collecting plasma products from impoverished, financially desperate people in the U.S. and from and overseas, from Nicaragua and other places like that. And they were importing this knowing that there was a high degree of viral contamination. They're importing and pooling this plasma. And so I began to look into this, and with Senator Jackson's support, we actually launched a small investigation of the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate, which we ran for over a year. And we sent out letters asking about the issue of viral contamination to the major drug companies. And because the way in which it had an immediate impact is that the drug companies were making this concentrated product, and then they were trying to market it overseas. And where it was one of the primary issues was hepatitis, whereas most American hemophiliacs had already been exposed to hepatitis A and B. Many people in England, many boys, had not. So they were becoming quite sick with hepatitis as the result of receiving American products, which the American firms were promoting as superior to British products. And they were not superior, except in maybe some very small technical ways. And they were making people sick. And this, so I raised the issue, and there were, and even got into, I mean, this is what's quite fascinating in retrospect, even got into why the pharmaceutical companies were not committing to heat treatment in order to increase the safety of the blood supply. And we got back some answers, you know, because this all came out on U.S. Senate stationery and with Senator Jackson's signature on it. We got back a wide range of material, but the gist of it was, a lot of explanations and excuses, but the biggest question around viral protection was the yield issue, you know, that if you heat-treated factor VIII, then your yield would go down and therefore the price would go up, and we can't do that, and we're not inclined to do that, and there's no reason to do that, and so forth. In 1975 and 76, when I was in college, I went back, and we actually continued this investigation with the thought that it might become a full set of hearings. And I worked, I mean, there's some irony here, but I worked directly for an attorney who later became famous for other things, Elliot Abrams, who went on to become a big official in the Reagan administration and so forth. But at the time, he was a Democrat, and I was assigned to him, and we worked on this issue together. 1976, this was still dragging on, but Scoop Jackson said, two things happened. Scoop Jackson said, I want to have these hearings. I really am disturbed by what we're learning. But he was running for president, and basically he said, well, if I become president, I'll be able to do a lot more about this, and if I'm not president, we can come back and revisit this. And then, simultaneously, the senator from Illinois, Charles Percy at that time, received information and pressure from the companies based in Illinois, which included Baxter, in which they said it is totally inappropriate for a biased young man with hemophilia to be involved in this investigation. And so Senator Percy, who I otherwise admired, went to the minority counsel of the Senate Investigation Subcommittee and said, yes, and said, and he called me into his office without any warning and basically delivered my first experience in hardball politics. He said, we are willing to consider moving forward with this investigation with Senator Jackson, and we are willing to even consider issuing subpoenas for it, but only on one condition, which is that you personally recuse yourself and withdraw from any connection to this, because Senator Percy, i.e. his major corporate constituents, feel that you shouldn't be involved in this. Well, this is a battle that I couldn't fight or really win. I went back and told the general counsel, and told the senator, and he was really, really pissed. But you know, presidential politics and life intervened. But
so, how did you feel then when this whole thing blew up, and actually the companies were ultimately sued and had to settle, and it became very clear to everyone that this was all going on?
Well, I mean, you asked me did how this affected me politically.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a horrendous system in the United States, both in terms of the creation and in the distribution of healthcare. Now, we have wonderful science going on and wonderful wonderful care for those who can afford it. But one of the things we have is much of the research, for example, that led to the commercialization of Factor VIII was done under government funding. In North Carolina and other places, when that government funding demonstrated that this was a viable way to approach the concentration of Factor VIII, those, and I don't remember all the details of this, those contracts and licenses were acquired by firms who then made just an extraordinary amount of money. I also ran some calculations, this long before I went to college, let alone business school, but I ran some calculations on what was the likely volume of, you know, how many AHF units per year were being produced by the U.S. industry total. And, you know, you could figure that out by figuring out roughly what the U.S. population was, and hemophilia population, and roughly what their treatment dosage was. And so you could get a sense of the total thing. And then you multiply that by what they're charging per AHF unit, and it was hundreds of millions of dollars. And then you ask, well, what is their operating costs, and then what's the margin? And, you know, it was, even under the most conservative estimates, they're making tens of millions, and very quickly hundreds of millions of dollars. And when you have a product that, where you have essentially a captive population, there is, in economics, there's no elasticity of demand around whether you need Factor VIII or not. You have a group who are forced to seek and obtain this product through whatever means they can. Then you can charge whatever you want. And, you know, to carry it one step further, there's even a disincentive to create advancements, because this is such, in what I later learned in business school, this is such an unbelievable cash cow. It throws off so much cash that allows you to do other kinds of research and pay your shareholders a lot more money. But anyway, so the system, for me, one thing I learned is that there's always a bias against safety, because people want to move a product out and they don't want to hear bad news. And now, I don't want to cast aspersion on everybody in the entire U.S. medical system, and I know there are some people who care a lot about this and have learned from their mistakes. But I think there's no question that in this instance, and in other instances that followed, commerce overwhelmed science and did end up exposing a great many people, including me. To put not too fine a point on it, if in response to the hepatitis concerns that were already well established in the mid-1970s, the pharmaceutical companies had decided to pursue a system of viral inactivation or HEAT treatment, there would have been no HIV catastrophe for the hemophilia community. And that speaks for itself. I mean,
how do you make peace with something like this, or do you?
Well, it depends what you mean by make peace.
How do you come to terms with something like this when you, even way back then, you knew that it was unsafe and, as you say, the economics of it drove it. How do you and so many others...
One decision that I made, which not everyone agreed with, but which is, I think, a response to your question, is that I did not turn this into the great crusade of my young life. When Journey, my parents' book Journey, came out, I was asked to come and speak, and I enjoyed very much doing that. I spoke 30, 40 different places in the country, and it gave me a chance to see America and to meet hemophilia communities and to see what was going on and to speak to, and I was appointed to the American Blood Commission, which was a sort of quasi-public group looking at blood supply issues, and I was really the young hothead on that committee. But that was kind of as far as I wanted to go. I mean, I thought about obtaining a medical degree and going on, but I thought, I didn't choose to have hemophilia, and I don't necessarily want to spend my entire life with this as my frame of reference. Now,
so many people ended up so angry and so devastated by this event.
I don't know the answer. Why didn't I? Uh-huh. Because I think I understand that anger and that. And I don't want in any way to condemn it. I understand it, and I know people have suffered a great deal. And I think many of the things that were happening were just beyond outrageous. They were... So I think for me, it was a question of feeling that there were also other things that were outrageous in the world. And there were other injustices that needed addressing, and that I wanted to have just put a bigger frame on the whole thing. And for me, I've been involved as an activist for my entire life on a wide range of issues that sequentially have now allowed me to do quite a few things. But they're all rooted in this experience of hemophilia. And I still feel a great bond. I understand. Well, let me try to reframe this. I feel I was very fortunate to have extremely intelligent and aggressive parents in coping with this system. And they were, to use football, they were great blockers who allowed me to pass through what otherwise would have just been, crushing circumstances. But I was very aware, like, what would happen to someone who, if they didn't have this level of devotion, resources. My parents really had no money. People tend to think, I've learned over the last few years, that if you're a writer and you sell a book, you're instantly rich. My father wrote books that took very, very long time to write, for which he was not paid that much. So it was a living, but it was certainly not wealth. But they had gone to Ivy League equivalent schools on scholarships, and they're very smart, and they used this on my behalf. And
how did that lend to your feeling that your political activism was rooted in your hemophilia?
Well, for one thing, I realized that that your success in life, your access to basic forms of care. And here's where I did generalize that, whether it's a good doctor or a good home or even a good job, should not be determined by your connections. And that unless we have a system that is powerfully committed to inclusion and to equity, you are going to end up with a system that distributes benefits according to connections and not according to need or according to fairness. And that's the overwhelming instinct of our nation is, let's put it this way, it is a constant struggle which image of life is going to predominate. Is it the one where there's a basic sense of justice and basic sense of inclusion and fairness, where people who are not to blame for the things that have happened to them are given access to the resources to survive and to succeed, or whether it's just really going to be a lottery, that wherever you were born, whatever happens to you, you know, some people have crushing things and are simply wiped out, and other people are born to privilege and never have to think about a second thing. I think America is the America that I know and that I love and that I think people admire is the first one, not the second. The second is just a, paper mache version of aristocracy. Mm-hmm. So
justice plays an enormous theme in your life then.
Absolutely.
But
also, so does grace, which I, from a spiritual standpoint.
Tell me about that.
But before I do that, there's something I've been meaning to tell you, which goes back to this thing, and where I think there's a positive thing that needs to be said. In the mid-80s, around the time of the panic around AIDS and the scandalous silence by the president.
President Reagan.
President Reagan. There was an eruption of fear, and people began to tout ideas that were really frightening in their content. I mean, quarantine. People were beginning to suggest that maybe we should find an island off the coast of somewhere off the Atlantic coast, one of the Carolina Islands or something, and just put everybody with HIV there. Since America has gone through things like Japanese internment camps and so forth, these ideas were starting to gain currency. At one point, my father got into a absolutely ferocious battle with William F. Buckley, who was a classmate or class two ahead of him at Yale, and who my father basically liked, although didn't agree with his political views. But Buckley wrote a column which in his typical manner was both serious and sort of tongue-in-cheek, where he was suggesting, and he clearly, if the idea had taken off, I think he would have been happy to endorse it, but where he was basically suggesting that people with HIV should be tattooed in order to warn their sexual partners that they were in danger. My father publicly wrote a letter to Buckley, said, which was, and my father, who's normally a very reasonable man, when he gets angry, he is not. And he basically said, something pretty basic, like, if anybody tries to tattoo my son or anybody else, I'm going to come over there and tattoo your forehead, with bigot or something like that. This produced a back and forth in the, was in the New York Times or where for a while. And it took a number of years for my father and Buckley to get over it, and then they eventually got old enough and sort of rediscovered their friendship. But that debate was happening just below the surface. Reagan's silence countenanced, in a sense, some of that, even though many of the people who were affected were friends of his or alleged friends of his. This sense of horror and the sense that it was a gay plague and God's judgment on so forth. So America, and its constituent communities, but America as a whole had a very important decision to make here, which is whether the response to this was going to be one of fear, isolation, internment, tattooing, and who knows where that would have led, lynching. And there was enough currents of that going on. Or was it going to be a reaction of acceptance, compassion, engagement, and so forth. And I think if you look at the 1980s, that's part of the huge battle was for the soul of the United States and for pockets of the United States, what our approach was going to be to this. I think that one of the things that needs to be highlighted is that the response of the churches, and particularly the mainstream churches, you know, traditional, but also others, was first a little tentatively, but then absolutely firmly on the side of compassion. And that movement by the churches early and in some sense aggressively to say, we will countenance no other response, no other moral response by this nation, damped down what was otherwise this accelerating community of anxiety and you know, incipient cruelty. I mean, that's what was bubbling up.
So this is what you're speaking to, what came out good out of this whole...
America, I think, made the right choice.
Yeah.
And I think the forces of hatred, homophobia, of you know, the people who predicted that this would, that this was a plague brought on by an alien group who need to be isolated and punished for the... that argument, that framing of it, failed. And failed, in a sense, I mean, sadly for individual people, there were still pockets of bigotry and brutality that continued, and I think we can carry that right up to Matthew Shepard's death. But, White family, Ryan White's family, was treated absolutely horribly. I believe his home was burned down. So it's not something where we want to say that America escaped completely, but the weight of decision and public judgment, and I think the public leaders, the actors and actresses, the other public leaders who stepped forward and were willing to identify with people with HIV really helped there. But anyway, all of these things contribute to my emerging political and spiritual views, because that was a moment in time where America could have become something truly horrible, and chose not to be, chose to be compassionate. The other thing I just want to mention very briefly is that I got I had grown up my whole life with gay friends of the family, because my parents, particularly my mother, was very involved in the arts, and so I knew lots of gay people, and I sort of always knew that they were gay. I never really thought about it very much. But this all brought sort of homosexuality into much higher relief as something that to think about also as a pastor at that time. And one thing I will say is that I was awestruck by the love, patience, compassion, commitment demonstrated by many members of the gay community towards other people with HIV. And something that I think, if I had had any prejudices, I don't know what, but about, you know, about was homosexuality something that could induce a full and rich and committed set of relationships, those completely evaporated as I watched, you know, gay men particularly, give of themselves to other people through the most painful of circumstances, and with the strength that I think any human being would be proud and touched to see. I mean, this comes up later, you know, like in movies like Philadelphia, where we see a chance, you know, where that some of these issues are kind of played out. But that movie, I think, came out in the early 90s. I saw that well before then. So already by the time that, you know, I turned 30 in 1986, you know, these issues were all very, 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 very vivid for me. Now, I should mention that in 1986, I had already come to Boston to pursue a doctorate at Harvard Business School, having been a minister and still serving as a minister in a little church near here, and part of my conviction, and this was at the, you know, 1984-85 was when Reagan was reelected. I think somebody just dropping off the mail. Reagan was reelected, and it was really believed that the market could solve all problems. And so I took on endless debates in the Harvard Business School MBA program, because I had to do the first year of the MBA, on this question. And I remember in one, I think, probably overly melodramatic moment, when they were talking about the ability of supply and demand to solve all problems, I remember whipping out my factor eight out of my thing and, you know, saying, take a good look at this. You know, let's talk about the cost structure of this. Let's talk about what people have to do if they can or can't pay for this. And it was one of those situations where it was so overwhelming that people just cringed. Nobody talked to me for a day or two. It's like, oh man, we don't want to get into all that stuff. But
it brought the whole emotional and real piece of individuals' lives into the...
Well, and that's something that I feel very strongly that we are called to do. I mean, mm-hmm. that the way most people, I mean, politically and spiritually, the way people address most problems initially is through denial, segregation, avoidance, you know, the resolution of cognitive dissonance so that the unpleasant thing disappears. That is an understandable response, but it is the immature response. It is the response that we permit of children or of teenagers because it's all too much. But adults are expected to have open eyes and to be able to accept the idea that not everything in the world lines up perfectly with what their views of how things ought to be. And so that ability to be able to see and not to take some overarching system and say, well, that's going to explain or obscure all problems that I encounter. One of the reasons I've been so public about my circumstances is because I feel I have a duty to help people make the transition from a superficial assessment to a more mature assessment of what's going on, even as they have a duty to help me do it on other issues. Mm-hmm. And in the sense that you can see that leads me into ministry and into political life and into writing. But what's important for me to say is that when I got into the pulpit, you know, I never started a sermon saying, I have hemophilia and therefore I can pronounce to you. When I wrote a 800-page book on South Africa, I don't think I ever mentioned that I had this. But my understanding of what can happen when a human community decides that, you know, that one part of a human community decides that it has to be afraid of and control another community because of their appearance or because of something they might do to them over the long run, and the grotesque self-justifications that can flow from that are then accepted by others as real, when in fact they're nothing but excuses and tyranny. That fueled all of my research and my awareness that those things are not far away from us. I mean, even taking things like what happened in the Second World War in the treatment of Jews and by the Nazis, one of the things that's always sort of horrified me is our sense that, gee, that was an incredibly awful, terrible thing. But it was such an isolated thing. Those Nazis were really bad, and it was a special situation. And of course it was a special situation in its uniqueness and its vastness. But the notion that those Germans or those situations are somehow held in time and can be walled off from all other people and all other experiences, that's dangerous. The truer reality for me is that we're all about two steps away from doing that again, and it is only by being very vigilant in our compassion that we avoid sliding right back down that track as we almost did with HIV, and as I fear we're doing now on a whole range of other things.
Bob, tell me about grace. What does that mean to you?
Well, I wish I could give you a short answer about that, but the truth is, it's a concept that, it's more than a concept, it is a way of being or that has touched me very greatly and forms one of the guiding questions and principles of my life. And so I don't think that I will ever understand it completely. But what it means is that we tend to live in a world in which we react to each other through complicated systems of approval. And the more you respond and do the things that I approve of, the more we like you. And the less you do, the more we dislike you. And all of our lives are built on this, that, you know, school is built on this, and job performances are built on this, and social hierarchies are built on this, and politics is built on this. And so it's a sense that your value as a human being and your capacity to love and be loved is determined by measurement against some outside standard, and often multiple outside standards, including your relationship to the eternal, to the creator God, to the universe that we live in. That and what's interesting is many people who have quite profound religious feelings and training still feel this too. You know, it's kind of the, what most people think of as, you know, basic Christianity, or also other religions, like, if you're a good person, you'll go to heaven. If you're a bad person, you won't. And if you're a good person, this is this one of the core ideas in the Bible, then good things will happen to you. And then if you look around at all the people bad things are happening to, you must think, well, they must have done something wrong. And that's very explicit in the Bible, and particularly in the book of Job, where all these terrible things happen to Job, and his friends come around him, and they imagine they're trying to help him by pushing him to rack his brains to identify exactly what it was he did wrong that led to all of this punishment.
Did you go through that, having gotten all these chronic illnesses?
Well, I think I was exposed from a very early age to something, I think, about as close to unconditional love as you can get in this life from other people. My parents, who had lots of challenges in front of them, and who I, as an adult, I certainly see some of the limitations that they had in themselves to cope with and in each other, but they loved me unquestioningly. Their support for me was just so overwhelming that in the moments when I was most exposed or in pain or in danger, I never, and in many things that I had to fear, the one thing I didn't have to fear was the withdrawal of their love. And I think that set up a core set of convictions about the power of love and about my own self-worth, which was an essential ingredient. You know, these are in some sense mysterious, but which was an essential ingredient in everything I was able to do and be afterwards.
And is this a core piece of your spirituality? Does this tie into it at all?
Absolutely.
Tell
in
me
fact,
what you
well,
mean.
Because as I mentioned briefly, there's kind of a popular shorthand for what religion means, and particularly for various forms of Christianity mean, which is do good, get reward; do bad, get punished. And but the core idea that really captured me, that I'd always kind of sensed, but really, in my view, is at the heart of the Christian gospel, and I think is also part of many other traditions, but for me as a Christian, it's absolutely the heart of my faith, is the idea that ultimately our relationship with God has nothing to do with our performance. It has to do with simply God's desire to love God's created beings, children, and this may be my wife, which is why the phone rings and then the cell phone rings right afterwards. But
do you want to get it?
No. And there are many passages in the New Testament which basically, and also many passages in the Gospels, in the life of Jesus and Jesus' own words, where the emphasis is on love over and above and without regard to performance. So, I mean, I'm thinking of doing some writing about this at some point, but, you know, a simple example is the parable of the Good Samaritan, where, you know, it sets up, Jesus is asked, what are the greatest commandments? He asks the person to say, well, what do you think? And that person says, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus says, that's right. The person then, as it says in the scripture, seeking to justify himself, says, oh yeah, okay, but who's my neighbor? Exactly who does this apply to? And then Jesus tells the story about man beaten and left by the side of the road, and then three people who go by. The first one is a priest, that is someone who one would expect, would recognize, this is all told in a Jewish context, so would recognize this person and would stop, and now they go on. Next is a Levite, a person who also would be understood to have special duties to fulfill the laws of compassion. The third person would go by is a Samaritan, with whom there were fundamental religious disputes. Samaritans denied the authority of the temple, thought you should worship God somewhere else. So, what's so interesting about this is that Jesus does not ever actually lecture this guy. His interchanges consist primarily of these questions. So at the end of the story, he says, who proved neighbor to the man by the side of the road? And the person who's inquiring says, the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus says, go and do likewise. The point is that the lawyer, the person asking, was looking for some definitional mechanism which would allow him to apply his compassion to one group but not to another. And yet, in constructing this story the way he did, the lawyer himself concludes that the boundaries of compassion are limitless. Another story, which I won't go through the whole thing of, but is the prodigal son, where if there were ever a person who deserves to be punished in some sense, it's this young man who goes and takes half of his father's inheritance and completely squanders it on wine and women and comes back, and even he recognizes that he has completely blown it, and his aspiration is to be hired as a servant, at least to get a job as a servant, since he knows that he's no longer qualified. And he instead is received as this son, and they kill the fatted calf, and they have a great party. One of the pieces I love about that story most is that it doesn't end there. It's not just about the nice father welcoming his son back, but the other son, the older son, who's been very dutiful, comes back in and hears the party and says, what is going on? He calls the servant out and says, what's going on? He says, oh, okay, it's great news. Your brother's back after all these years, and the father's killed the fatted calf. And he makes his father come out to see him, and he says, this jerk took half your money, went and spent it, and now you're having a party. And it actually says in scripture, in a way, one of the things I love about it, he says, you're giving him a party, which you never did for me and my friends. It's like, it's not fair. And the father's response is, you have always been with me. Everything that I have is yours. Of course I love you. Your brother was lost and now he's found. He was dead and now he's alive. So what I take away from that is, and one of the key dynamics in that story is that the person who's having the biggest problem with forgiveness is the older brother, who feels that the structure of correctness should dominate You know, it's like, yeah, he's been dead. We didn't know where he was. But what's important is that he shouldn't get a party, not that he's bad. So it's this disproportion. And between, and that's one of the things that has affected me tremendously, is that that I feel we are constantly being drawn into these systems that make us disproportionately small and fascinated with how much better we are than somebody else, and deny to us the community of compassion in which we recognize that in our failure and weakness, which is universal, we are able to love and care for each other. And instead of being preoccupied with, I'm a little bit better than you, I have a little bit more stuff than you, and God's going to like me more better because I've been, you know, I've been a better student of life, and I've got more gold stars. I mean, that's just, that's antithetical to what Jesus is trying to describe. And so that, and what is it that it disrupts and heals this passion, this obsession with hierarchy? Is grace. It's the idea that ultimately we are all recipients of and deserving of an unbounded love that is not tied to what we manage to do, or that, and that it will not be withdrawn if we, through our humanity, end up doing something absurd and stupid, which is what humans do constantly.
Do you think having hemophilia, it sounds like the unconditional love that you spoke so poignantly about had a huge effect on your life. But also, what about these challenges of having hemophilia since you've been a child, pain since you've been a child? We've talked a lot about how hard that was in many ways. Do you have any sense of there were good things that came out of these challenges?
Well, let me, it's funny, I thought your question was going in a slightly different direction. So let me answer the question I thought you were going to ask.
Okay, and what was the question?
Well, the question I thought you were going to ask is, how, you know, what is this feeling of grace somehow tied to, or in some sense, how could it be tied to, since you have been the unwilling recipient of so much difficulty? And I think that I am very, very keenly aware on a daily basis of how, yes, I have some troubles, but relative to many people who have lived through the eons of human generations or living now, I mean, I am a great creature of comfort and privilege. I was in India a number of years ago, and I was taking a taxi from the airport to the hotel where I was going to be chair of a big set of meetings. And, you know, as you're zooming in and trying to absorb the unbelievable and overwhelming sights of India, we stopped at a red light at one point, and I noticed a little girl, very small little girl, maybe 3 years old, 4 years old, sitting in the gutter, and, you know, obviously completely destitute. And what really was a bolt through my heart was that she had another little girl who was smaller, 2 years old maybe, 18 months old, with her head in her lap, and she was stroking the hair of this girl who was trying to sleep with the car zooming by and so forth. And I thought, you know, and that's a particularly vivid and disturbing image, but I could tell you thousands of things that I have observed that make, you know, from just you know, simplest things. Excuse my stomach, that's all my medicine I'm taking. I used to not be able to walk, and my highest aspiration of my whole life was that I would be able to walk again. And now I can walk, and I don't want to be one of these people who says, well, thank you, and now that I got the highest aspiration of my whole life, and now I have a new list of highest aspirations of my whole life. Well, of course you do. That's what human beings do. You know, say thanks very much and move on. But even as I move on, I need to remember that I got the highest aspiration of my life. And that's true also when I look at my children, when I look at the educational opportunities I've had, when I, you know, just on and on and on and on. So that's the question I thought you were going to ask, is sort of how do you make relative... And I I don't condemn people who feel terribly burdened by what has happened to them. I think that's an understandable human response. I think that as long as people remain in that place where they're focused on all that has been taken away from them, this image in their head of the way life should have been, and they've been denied that, and that source is a source of pain and anger, frustration, and so forth, and basically defined as injustice that can only be rectified, I think you are putting yourself in a position where you can never be happy. And so I understand how people find themselves in that place. I've certainly been there sometimes, but I think spiritual growth is about moving away from these pictures in our head about what we deserve, what we've earned, what we ought to have, and what is fair, which is what governs most of our thinking, into what we actually have, what is happening right in front of us, and all of these things that we take for granted, but then that are unbelievable gifts, just unbelievable gifts and opportunities to start with, to the ability to draw breath and live. Unbelievable gift.
What I was trying to get at before is people perceive hardship sometimes as just that, just hardship.
Yeah.
And my question, I guess, is do you feel anything positive can come out of hardship?
Well,
like hemophilia or disease?
I think I do. I mean, I'm not one of these people. I don't say that lightly. I mean, I know that some people say, oh, you know, I'm stronger for the experience. That's certainly not a reason ever to wish anything on anyone. But I think that going through hard things, ideally, and in many cases, can make you more compassionate because you understand the suffering of others.
Do you feel it's made you more compassionate?
Oh, there's no question about it. You know, I sometimes think, what kind of person would I have been if I hadn't had hemophilia? Well, I can say that some things probably would have been very much the same, the energy, the enthusiasm, curiosity, and so forth. But I think the arrogance would have been much greater. I think I would have, that's not to say I'm without arrogance now, but, you know, the image I have in my head is, you know, I would have wanted to become a fighter pilot and an astronaut and a hotshot, you know, that would have been fun to go zooming around and be a tough guy and so forth. But what I realized that I so easily could have been a straight, white, privileged male in the dominant country of its era in some position of great authority and wealth, and that I could have achieved all of those things, and my predominant response to them could have been, I did it, why couldn't anybody else? And one of the mysteries that the Bible talks about quite a lot is how is it that good fortune produces hardness of heart? Doesn't always, but, you know, you would think that the more good things happen to people, the more they would be humble and generous. In fact, when you look out, very often, the more good things happen to people, the more judgmental they are of people to whom bad things have happened, and the more tightly they control what they have. Now, that's a response that's kind of mysterious to me. Now, in political terms, when I was running for office, I would say, and still believe this, and if I ever go back out into more public debate, I would say, I mean, I think it is totally unacceptable to have a system in which not only do we have widespread poverty and disease, but that we blame the poverty on the poor, and we blame the suffering and the disability on the disease as though we still have this biblical mentality that if you are having so much trouble, it must be because of something you did wrong. Now, of course, people make mistakes and can intensify their own problems, as I think I've made clear, believe that one needs to mobilize one's own sense of responsibility and agency and move out of victimhood and into strength. But one of the ways you do that is by that people give you resources and affirm that you can do it. But we live in a culture now which basically says, if you're sick, it's your own damn problem, probably your own fault, and if you're poor and you stay poor, it's because you're not working hard enough. I find that backward, offensive, statistically and morally wrong.
If you were to, let me move this more around the hemophilia, because what you're saying is when things happen, it's important to mobilize them, you know. If you were to speak to a family who just found out that they had a child with hemophilia, you know, what advice would you have for them, if any? Or if your daughter one day down the road had a child with hemophilia, would you have anything to say to them?
Well, I think I actually learned this morning about someone who's a member of our congregation who has just discovered, this is kind of a distant connection, but through the congregation, that a grandchild of theirs has hemophilia, and my pastor was asking me what I thought about that. I think in the first instance, when you're talking to a family who's experiencing that, the first piece is to help them grieve, because we go through life by building up these elaborate senses of what the future is going to be like, and how we're going to get there and how we deserve that to come. I mean, as I say, my wife and I use this term, the pictures in the head. And losing the pictures in the head is, and the sense of the narrative of your life. My life began here and then here, and I get married and I have children. My children are going to grow up in such and such a way. And losing the thread of that narrative is very painful. In fact, one Catholic writer defines that as the essence of suffering. Pain is one thing, but suffering is the loss of a narrative that gives life, your life, meaning. And he applies that, I think, very effectively to talk about people who are trying to recover from war-torn situations where their entire life structure has been eliminated, and they have to try to reconstruct some order and some image of the future that's radically different from what they originally had. So I think the first thing is helping people, step through the sorrow about that whatever it was they imagined may not happen. But that's also part of growing up. The second piece is many more things, but you're not going to lose everything. I mean, many of the things that right now you may think are going to be gone for good are in fact probably still going to be able to be to happen. I mean, and then you start being able to say things like, and the care is so much better, and you know, a child can achieve autonomy, and you know, so the things that one longs for in a child, which is to sort of to free the child from suffering and to enable that child to grow into full and happy and free individual, those are all still possible for both the child and for you as a parent. Then, sort of getting past that, so you don't have to, you're not giving up everything. Many, many things can happen, will happen. And then the third thing I would say is, is really focus on this question of unconditional love, and that the greatest tool that you can give to a child, I think any child, but especially one who's coping with a chronic illness and potentially facing lots of added on judgments and trials from others, is the sense that, you know, you're in there for them no matter what. And that that doesn't mean you have to be perfect or that you have to always be, you know, loving. You can be strong and you can provide guidance on proper behavior and discipline when necessary, but the core idea is that we don't love you any less because of what you're going through, and there's nothing that you can do that's going to break that bond. I think if, you know, if parents can internalize that, if they can hear that, then and I guess the final thing is being willing, and so many parents are, so it's really unnecessary advice in many cases, but just being willing to mobilize the resources that are out there and to recognize that one is not lost in some isolation, but that there's a community of people who have experience, who have resources, who are willing to help you out, and that the only thing really that will deny you access to that is your own decision to remain, or your, maybe it's not a decision, but if you remain frightened and withdrawn, then you are cutting off the ability of so many others to provide you with what you need. So I think isolation is a danger in all kinds of issues of suffering. As a pastor, I've seen that in many, many, many different settings, I mean, including, you know, just come through a long challenge with this senior friend who lives across the street. But so, but yeah, I think that's what I would say. Although I would really wait to be invited to say something, because I think that's also lots of free advice offered without invitation isn't always the best thing.
Bob, we've really covered many of the subjects that I wanted to cover today. Is there something that I haven't asked you that you want to include in this oral history?
I think there may be two things that come to mind. One is that for all of this talk about acceptance and so forth, this was, and I've alluded to it before, it was a great trial when I was divorced, because what essentially happened, I mean, to boil it all down, is that the person that I trusted to love me unconditionally and forever, my expectation picture in my head, suddenly announced that she didn't. And not only she did not love me, but she didn't even like me very much. And that for her own well-being, I needed to leave her life. That experience was far more destructive than any of the physical suffering that I had, because in line with what we were talking about, I had a narrative, a story about my life that included fidelity to my wife, who I admired and loved, who was different from I was, but not in ways that I thought were anything but interesting. And then suddenly that was entirely shattered. And I think there was a real question in my mind as to whether I could restore, you know, find, make sense of all that and find love again. I did, and I have an incredible wife, Anne, who had been a friend of mine before and had not married. And Anne understands me better, and I think I've achieved a level of peace and safety in my relationship to her that exceeded anything I had with Dana. So I guess I raise this because I think that as a word of hope, to, because I don't think, no matter how hard we work, I don't think we can guarantee that our human relationships are all going to work out. And people marry for a lot of reasons, and people, you know, agree to get married for a lot of reasons. And, you know, not all of those things survive the all the different demands. In our case, the appearance of HIV just put so much new stress on what perhaps wasn't the strongest relationship anyway. But I think that my experience was of a kind of death, but a kind of resurrection into a new life of love and comfort and mutual support. The second thing I want to say is that you haven't asked me very much about having children, I mean, about being a father.
And, let me ask you about that then.
Well, I would just say that I love being a father. I don't pretend to understand how my children have internalized or made sense of all of the medical problems that I face. I mean, in one sense, I'm candid about them, and they're part of our daily life. They've seen me have shots. They know when I have a bandage on my arm. They know this. You know, we sat down and talked to them about hepatitis, and my daughter, Kate, who's six, raises this, is that she has divided her life and her engagement with me into things that she can do with me now and things that she will be able to do with me after my operation. She likes to roughhouse and meaning a liver transplant. Mm-hmm. We've said, you know, I'm going to get this big operation at some point and then I should be healthier. So Kate has sort of classified, and that's helpful for her because, you know, she realizes, okay, there's certain things I can't do, but we hope that I will be able to do. And then most of these have to do with energy. I just have so little energy. You know, we face some, I don't know what kind of parenting lessons my sons will have taken away. Of course, you worry when you've gone through divorce that that's a very dangerous thing to be leaving them with. But Dana and I have managed to live a few blocks apart from each other and continue to parent as children together, and I think that's worked out. So I think Anne has played a role in all of that, and so I think that worked out far better than my early fears. But thinking about being a parent, I mean, one of the ways we actually joke about this, my son John is incredibly into sports, and of course I have virtually no experience playing sports, but we tease about this. The little fiction we have going is that I, in fact, was a great sports hero, that I won the Heisman Trophy, that I was, you know, drafted for the NBA, that I had to pick between that and my stellar baseball career. So John will say things like, we'll be watching the Celtics, and he said, you know, some old player, and he'll say, oh, you must remember him from your days, Dad. And I said, yes, I taught him everything he knows. And, you know, we joke about that, and it's quite funny as a running joke. Both of us imagining me as a running back or as a shortstop or things like that. It's fun for me to think about it. It's fun for him to think about it. And we both know that there's a sort of little wry sadness in it, but it also means that we can embrace it. And there's a third thing that I just want to mention, which is that right now, even as we're talking, I'm going through a most amazing experience, one of the most amazing experiences of my life, because for me to have a new life, restored energy and, you know, and possibly literally curing my hemophilia, I need to go through a liver transplant from a living donor. And for many months we've been talking about this, and a few months ago we sent out a letter to a close circle of family members and a few friends, and we were disappointed to find out that the most likely candidates, who are three cousins of mine, big strapping young men in their 30s, early 30s, who were when my aunt heard about this, she said, oh, one of my sons will do it. And every one of them said, oh, we'll do it. One of them, we'll just draw straws. Well, they're all the wrong blood type. So that was disappointing. But just in the last 10 days or so, we released a new version of this letter to the members of our church. And I'm just awestruck that seven or eight of them have stepped forward and said, we want to be tested. We want to be... And this is not... I haven't even sent it to my friends through my environmental work, my former students, my wider circle of, you know, college friends. I mean, just this one community, we have seven or eight people who are going to go meet, some of them have already met with the doctor, going to go meet with the doctor. And from that pool, perhaps, will emerge a donor. And so, you know, I think about this a lot in spiritual terms. One of the things is Jesus says, phrased in the old King James way, is, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man would lay down his life for a friend." And rather male language, but that somebody would lay their life down, or put it at risk on behalf of someone else, is an act of generosity and grace that is incredible. And I may end up being the recipient of that, yeah, sometime even in the next year, and then may be able to go on. The pictures in my head are a little fuzzy right now as to what the future represents, but I may be able to go on to new things, unimaginable things right now. And so how do you take, when you start with that you were the recipient of this great love and support from your parents, imperfect beings though they were, that you've been a recipient through your whole life of the best that a medical system could offer, even though sometimes you had to yank it out of them, that I have been graced with many things that many otherwise healthy people have not had the chance to have for whatever reason, for 3 children and, an interesting career. And now I have survived HIV for reasons that are absolutely also unclear. I have had HIV for 26 years. I'm only 48, so for more than half my life, and I'm still here drawing breath and enjoying my life. And now you add to that that somebody may give up a portion of their own liver in order to give me an extended life and to free me permanently from hemophilia. That's just an amazing story. And what kind of life should flow from that? It seems to me somehow a life of great rejoicing and great generosity. I don't know how exactly. And a life, if I have the time and energy to move forward, what I would want to be able to do is give other people hope, because what we live in is a world where people try to steal or crush each other's hope all the time, and to suggest that whatever world we're in is the world we're going to be trapped in, or one that's worse. And for me, even through all of these difficult things, I have had this opportunity to go into worlds that are better. And I think we can do that as a community, too. And the other thing is, even if this all ends, not really that well, let's say I don't get a transplant or I get it and it doesn't work, I'm really not at all afraid of the future, because, I just feel my life has been so unbelievably rich, even with all the challenges right up and through now. None of that can be taken away. It's all part of who I am, what I've been able to do, and who I've been able to love and care about. And so that's all exists already in its fullness. So we're talking about adding to that.
Thank you.
Thank you.